to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome to our show. It's Saturday, end of the week. We're going to be looking back over the news of the last 5 days here. So far today, it looks like we've got our little technical issues sorted out. We're watching the little machine that tracks what's going on over our internet connection. As you know, we were having some internet dropouts Thursday, and yesterday the line went dead completely. We're still not sure if it's hackers or just Roadrunner being their normal incompetent selves, but we are going to keep an eye on what's going on here today and deal with those issues as they arrive. Before we get into the news here, I want to comment on something we heard on this last news break, because they're talking about this rocket attack supposedly from Gaza that sort of went near a town in Israel named Ashkelon. Now, it's a small rocket. It hit an absolutely empty piece of desert. No injuries, no deaths, no damage. And yet it's getting a big buildup in the news. Ooh, rocket misses everything. Film at 11. Meanwhile, we're getting these Israeli warplanes that are flying over Gaza in defiance of Israel's own declared ceasefire. They're firing rockets and bombs. They're wounding children. They're doing the same thing they've been doing all along, and nobody comments on it, except, of course, the blogosphere and radio shows such as this one here on GCN. So it's just another indicator of the double standard that we're seeing in the media, where when Gaza sneezes and does absolutely no real effect, it's headline news. But everything that Israel is doing in Gaza is being minimized and downplayed. Okay, we'll get back to Israel and Gaza later on. I want to talk about the economy now. And the economy obviously is not doing well at all. Last month, the January was the worst for the Dow and the Standard & Poor's in history. The worst January in history. The spin we're getting from the corporate media is, well, it's not as bad as we were expecting. Therefore, you know, we should be celebrating and, you know, have fun, go to the Super Bowl and buy plenty of those wonderful American products to consume as you watch the football game and everything. And it's kind of hard to say, you know, what's going on, because there's so much hemming and hawing and fudging about the figures. It's hard to know what they were really expecting it to be and whether it really is better or, in fact, it's worse. We do know that yesterday, as is their usual practice of waiting until close of business on Friday, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation closed down three more banks. Ocala National Bank in Florida, Suburban Federal Savings in Crofton, Maryland, and Magnet Bank in Salt Lake City, Utah, were all shut down and taken over by the FDIC. Now, meanwhile, we're looking at the unemployment numbers, which are edging up and edging up. And as I mentioned yesterday when we talked about 100,000 jobs lost in the month of January. In the last week of January. I have that wrong. And you know, how bad these numbers are. And I said these numbers don't tell the whole story, because they're not including people who are self-employed. They're running their own businesses, and their customers have gone away. And so these people aren't listed as unemployed, even though they're not working and they're not making money. So now John Williams, founder of Shadow Government Statistics, not the composer, different John Williams, calculates that the jobless rate in the United States is 10% higher than the government is reporting. In other words, it's not 7, almost 8%, it's 17, almost 18%. At the height, or the depth, of the Great Depression of 1929 and the following years, unemployment topped out at 25%. One out of every four Americans was unable to find work. So if this shadow government statistics is correct, we're getting close to that already. We're between 17 and 18% unemployment right now. And, you know, we're having, again, we're hearing more and more layoffs. California has just told their government offices to start furloughing their employees, to give them mandated days off without pay every month in order to trim their payrolls there. 46 out of 50 states could go bankrupt in the next 2 years. I mean, that is exactly how tight it's getting out there. Looking at some of the other news, General Motors has announced it is going to invest $1 billion, that's with a B, in their Brazil operation. The bad news is they're taking this out of the money they got from the U.S. rescue program. And when they were talking about doing this before, we raised a really big stink, because here's the deal. They're taking money from American citizens, and they're giving it to General Motors, and General Motors is taking it down to Brazil to build up the factory they have down there to give Brazilians jobs. Now, you ought to be really angry about that. I am, and I don't even work in the auto industry. I don't even buy cars from General Motors. But, I mean, if this is not the ultimate slap in the face, when our country is in such terrible, terrible situation right now, General Motors goes to the government, gets a bailout, and it takes that money, takes a billion of that money, takes it down to Brazil to improve the factory down there for all the workers they hired there when our government gave them tax breaks to make it easier to ship those jobs to other countries. It's a totally, totally screwed up system. It is not taking care of the American people. American industry and American government are taking care of each other. They are not taking care of the American people, and it kind of makes them useless to we the people, if you want to know my opinion about that. Now, the California pension funds are close to bankruptcy, and of course, this is the week that California is going to start issuing IOUs for welfare payments, student loans, various other entitlement programs. They're still trying to work out a deal with banks where banks will accept the IOU as having value for a deposit. So the state says, I owe you $200, and you can put that in the bank, and you can write checks on it. So far, we've not heard confirmation that the banks are going to go along with this deal, because nobody knows how the IOUs are going to be paid. And when those welfare IOUs start to bounce, I think we're going to see California start to join the rest of the world in the protests and, in some cases, rioting that we are seeing as the people of the world begin to realize just how badly the world economic system has just totally, totally messed them over. We're talking about, you know, protests shut down France. 75% of the French people supported the protesters. There's open talk of revolution now in Europe. Governments are getting worried that, you know, if the economy collapses anymore, people are going to just start rioting and calling for the government to get kicked out, like has already happened in Iceland. We're hearing about protests in Mexico, Siberia. Protests are continuing in Greece, Bulgaria, Hungary, Britain. It is widespread, and it's all over the place. And the reason for that is that people around the world are realizing that the government and the economic system they have been living under is not designed to make their lives any better. It's designed to extract the maximum work product out of them for little more than it takes to keep them alive. The financial system is designed to keep the wealth concentrated in the hands of a very few, and the people of the world are fed up. Now, if people are left to be comfortable, they get a nice, comfortable home, they know their kids' education is going to be taken care of, they know their health is going to be taken care of, they're willing to put up with a lot of corruption. They really are. People are, you know, they're going to vote with their wallets. And they say, all right, so, you know, the rich are getting really, really rich. But as long as I have a comfortable life for myself and some security for the future, let them go do what they're going to do with the rest of it. The problem is that as the craving for wealth beyond dreams of Midas infected the upper levels of our society, that desperate grasp for more and more money has reached the point where it is now affecting our lives, those of us in the working class. It's affecting our lives. We're seeing our work of a lifetime melt before our very eyes, and we're getting angry. And we have every right to be angry, and we have every right to hate the people who did this to us. Because we did not create this situation. The media is trying to blame all of us because we went out and borrowed money we shouldn't have to buy things we really didn't need, and it's all, therefore all our fault. But it isn't really, because we're not the ones who made the jobs go away. And more to that point, we live in a system that literally depends on us borrowing more money in order to create more wealth. And I'm going to explain that in detail in the next segment. So we're going to stop for a couple of commercials. If you want to join us on the air, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. Matt is answering the phones and twiddling the dials today, so call in and we will be right back.
Oh. Are you tired of searching for Freak Talk Radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. And I want to spend this segment really going into the economy in a great deal of depth. And I want you to grab your papers and pencils and take notes because there is going to be a quiz next period here. Now, we've been watching this last week, this Davos Economic Summit, and it has been punctuated by some very rancorous goings-on between the president of Turkey and the president of Israel, screaming at each other about genocides and holocausts, and a very biased moderator attempting to throw the discussion to Israel, to the point where the president of Turkey just stormed out of the meeting and went home in a huff and was greeted as a hero by his own people. Israel is attempting to recover from that embarrassment by trying to remind everybody of the Armenian Holocaust, and Turkey should mind its own business, and so forth and so on. But behind it all, behind all of that media distraction, if you will, basically we're seeing a lot of thrashing, and nobody can really come up with any kind of an idea how to fix things. And I've been saying this for some time now. They really don't know how to fix the economy. There isn't a fix for the economy. And the reason for that, I mean, the whole thing has to be drastically changed. Okay? And I'm not a socialist, and I don't favor more globalism for reasons I've already made very, very clear. But it comes down to what I call imaginary money. Now, it's all make-believe money. The Federal Reserve just prints it up on paper. It's not backed by anything but the good faith and trust of the U.S. government, which is a big reason we're in trouble right now. But there's a second type of make-believe money, which I call imaginary money, okay? And it doesn't really exist, but it's included on all the bookkeeping. And this is what I'm talking about, is the interest on money. Okay, so let us say in our system, somebody decides they're going to start a business. They go to the banks, the Federal Reserve, and they say, I want to borrow $1 million for 1 year. And the Federal Reserve prints up that money in response to the loan agreement. And the borrower takes the money. And at the end of that year, there is now $1 million plus the interest, $50,000, is owed back to the Federal Reserve. But there's a problem. There's only $1 million actually printed up and out there. That other $50,000 doesn't exist. It never did. It is an imaginary amount. Because there is no actual money to put into that number, $50,000. But it's on the books as having been earned. And it is a debt that is owed. But the money to pay that debt doesn't exist. Now, we the people, we're not allowed to just print up new money to cover our debts the way the government and the Federal Reserve does. They have a license to counterfeit. We do not. And the reason for that is really very simple. The money doesn't have any worth. The item of value is you. The person who is working is willing to indenture themselves to the banks for the period of the loan, where you promise that you will go out and you will work for somebody for the amount of work it takes to redeem that debt plus the interest. That's what a loan is. You are being indentured in servitude toward the bank that simply printed up the paper money out of thin air to give you in exchange for your labor. That's what's really going on. And the way the Federal Reserve works is new borrowers must be found or encouraged in order to justify the creation of new money, which then is used to pay the interest on the older loans. And this is why they're always talking about an expanding economy, the economic growth. The growth of the economy, they're really talking about an increase in the number of people willing to sign their lives over in exchange for some of this paper-printed money. And the system works only as long as there is an ever-increasing foundation of borrowers underneath the whole system who are justifying and through their labor creating the new money, which is then fed into the system to pay off the older loans going up to the top. Now, the problem that we have hit here is that because of the overpricing of housing estates and the subsequent fall in the prices and the vanishing of equity, everybody is all of a sudden cautious. We, the ordinary working people of the world, we know we have to live within our means. Governments don't have to. The banks don't have to. They've got the printing presses. But we have to live within our means, and we are being responsible about it. We didn't go out this last Christmas and buy a bunch of flat-screen plasma television sets on credit. We know better than to do that. We know better than to launch wars on credit. We know better than to borrow money to give to other countries without knowing how it's going to be paid back. So that new, larger group of borrowers is not forthcoming. And so the problem is now there's a lot of money that's out there in circulation. The Federal Reserve printed out to put up, and there is a lot of money owed on that money, the interest. But there is no money in existence with which to pay it. So there is this huge debt of accumulated interest out there, together with this huge debt of derivatives numbers, which also represent imaginary money that never existed in the first place that is now owed to somebody. And the people to whom it is owed, they don't want to write that debt off. So there's this huge debt of money that never existed in the first place, and it's being shoved around. The game is on to see who gets stuck with it, because somebody's going to have to eat that. Somebody's going to have to eat that debt. And what government and corporations are trying to do is make sure that you get to eat it. It's up to $8 trillion right now that we know of. And that all these bailouts and all of this other mechanical stuff going on, and the reason they're not paying that much attention to where the money is being spent, the purpose is, by virtue of borrowing on behalf of the American people and giving the money to the corporations and the banks and Wall Street, is to stick the people with the debt. Even though, at least as far as beyond your own personal mortgage and everything, you didn't agree to underwrite any of that debt. You certainly didn't agree to underwrite the debt obligations of all the derivatives. They're just sticking you with it. Now, the item of worth is you and your ability to work, the sweat of your brow and the strength of your back. And the people who believe that you owe that to them aren't going to relinquish it. They've gone to a great deal of effort to essentially enslave you with this paper money they print up out of thin air. They're not going to let that go without a fight. But the rest of the world has kind of, you know, figured that out. The bottom line is that the economy cannot be fixed, and this is the core flaw in the debt-based economic system that was brought in here with the Federal Reserve Act. There is always more money owed than actually exists. Someone has to eat that loss, and they're sticking you with it. Now, the rest of the world has figured that out. That's why we're seeing riots in Iceland and in France and in Spain and in Britain and in Bulgaria and in everywhere. It's breaking out all over because the people of the world have figured out that the system that they have been supporting with their taxes and their work and their loyalty was never set up to take care of them. It was set up to harvest the maximum amount of work product from the people in exchange for little more than it takes to keep them alive for their lifetime. It's like a big farm. You feed the cow enough to keep them alive, you put a roof over their head to keep the weather from killing them, and then you take their milk, and then eventually you kill them and you eat their flesh. That's what a farm is. We're a big human farm. We've got callers waiting on the line, and we are going to take those calls as soon as we come back from these words from our sponsors.
Public Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And remember, the more you call in, the less you have to listen to me talk. And we've got callers waiting on the line right now. We're going to go to Carolyn in Florida. Aloha, Carolyn. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Well, there are a couple of things on my mind.
Okay.
One is all of this debt that we owe to, say, China, and yet we're over there funding, you know, control over birth, and we're helping them with all this birth control, family, you know, keeping down the population, cutting back. Why is it we owe them all this money, and yet we do all these other services for them? And yet we
that is a
us.
Very, very good question. And
why can't we balance it out and say, look, we did this. This comes off of our debt we owe you.
You're absolutely correct there. When Barack Obama was announcing the reactivation of funding for birth control in other countries and abortions in other countries, you know, yes, these countries need to deal with the issues of population pressure because population is a major problem, and it always will be because sex is a lot more fun than dying. But we have a nation whose economy is in trouble. We've got American people, American children, sleeping in alleys and eating out of trash cans during one of the coldest winters in recent memory. Mm-hmm. And why are we sending our tax money to all these other governments? And as you said, yes, China has made a huge amount of money off of our marketplace. They're now complaining that because we're not buying their exports as much anymore, that they're having hard times. And yeah, why are we sending this money over there? I mean, does China, in its own interest, has been embarking on all these population control measures, some of them seen as quite brutal over the last several years. Why are we sending it? Or is this, in fact, as we've seen with a lot of the so-called anti-drug money that was going to South America, if it really is just called one thing, but it's a payoff or a bribe or it's almost impossible to know.
And then another thing, if you look and studied history, and it's documented, this is not made up. This is factual. And starting with the Rothschild family and how they acquired the money, and then the original Rothschild sent his five sons into different countries to open these banks. And they created, you know, they started wars so that they would make money. This has all been done. This is not legal. What they've done is, it wasn't right. This is criminal. Why do we then still owe them? If we've proven, you can prove what they've done, then why do we still owe these banks this money?
Because they own our government. I mean, we have been seeing, in fact, that was a story I was going to cover today. I'll bring it up right now. You probably heard last week Spain was opening up an investigation into Israeli war crimes.
Right.
And, you know, Israel said, we will protect our citizens, you will not touch them. And sure enough, today says Spain has announced they're going to change the war crimes law on their books so it doesn't apply to Israelis. And the idea is that since Israel is on the forefront of the war against terror, that these war crimes laws will not apply to them. So I guess dropping flaming white phosphorus on kids is now considered fighting terror. And Israel gets a free pass, proving once again that they are, relative to the rest of the world, above the law. This ties in exactly with what you're saying. We see time and time again these kinds of situations going on where, you know, any other person would be in jail or, you know, facing the gallows, and yet, for some reason, you know, these connected, linked interests, they seem to just walk above it all. And I think one of the reasons they're afraid of the idea of this global protest turning into a global revolution is that sooner or later, as the path of abuse is followed and the trail of abuse is followed to its source, you know, it is going to wind up basically bringing down these self-declared untouchable above the law types.
And then I feel if the United States focus more on, we have a pretty large continent here, and then go on down
yes.
into South America, Canada, and then of course Mexico. We have the resources to just cut off from these people. They're threatening us. We should take a stance and say, look, we can work with these people, and us against you, we've got, you know, we can call it just like it was with Russia. Now we've got a Cold War going on. We're uniting with South America, Mexico, America, and Canada, and we're not going to take it because we have more land mass, and we have intelligent people, and we have, you know, educated people, and focus on our side of the world.
Well, you know, this goes back to George Washington. In his farewell address, he said, beware of these foreign entanglements that can choke and strangle a country. And
well,
this
know,
is because...
This is all about survival. And, of course, it's their hides that they're worried about surviving. Cut them off. Why do we care? We can unite our side of the globe and go, we'll be the ones who will survive. We have the power. We have the land. We have more land per person. We can win this.
Well, I agree with you. That's certainly one school
it's
of
sort
thought.
Of a basic,
I'm not sure that I agree.
But when you've got something that's pretty damn solid base, you've got something to work with.
All right. Well, Carolyn, thank you for sharing that with us. We have to go on. We've got another caller waiting on the line, so thank you very much for the call. And we're going to switch over to Todd in Ohio. Aloha, Todd. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Yes, Mike. All kinds of things I could talk to you about. Well, first, with regard to California, I know that their economy seems to be worse off than the rest of the country, at least from the news reports I've seen. Now, would you think it's fair to say that this is directly the result of people allowing the media to dictate to them what issues are most important? And the example I would give is think back to 4 or 5 months ago. Which of these two issues was dominating California TV news coverage back then? Was it economic reform, fiscal reform, monetary reform, things of that sort, or was it gay marriage?
You're absolutely correct. The corporate American media, which is owned by the money interests, is going to point the American people where they want the American people looking. It's like a magician who gets you to look over in his left hand while the right hand is doing the real trick. It's called misdirection. We saw that all the way back in 2001, in the spring of 2001, when the U.S. government was on record informing other governments around the world of a plan to invade Afghanistan in October. We here in the United States, we're getting all Gary Condit all the time. We even coined a word out of it, conditization, meaning a deliberate media distraction. We're going to come up with a really tawdry sex scandal and death and murder and keep you all focused on that so that you're not paying attention while we tell the rest of the world we're getting ready to kick off a new war in Afghanistan. And so when September 11th comes around and boom, and all of a sudden we're aimed at Afghanistan, 9/11 happened exactly when the war planners needed it to whip up American anger for the war in Afghanistan, which had been announced to everybody else back in March of that year. So, yeah, the corporate mainstream media, that's the reason we've got the What Really Happened website. That's the reason for GCN to be here. It's the reason for Alex Jones. We understand that the corporate media has abandoned its role as watchdog on the abuses of government and business, and it's there to simply sell you things. The media is going to sell you that Saddam has got nuclear weapons hidden in his castle, underneath his mattress, in his cookie jar. The corporate media is going to sell you that, you know, Israel is right and just to be going in and stealing Palestinian land left and right and dropping phosphorus on anybody who disagrees. Their job is there to sell you things, to sell you the agenda, to sell you global warming, anything that's going to get more money out of you for less and less going back to your life. That's what it's really all about. Todd, hang on. We're going to keep you into the other side of the break because I know you got some other things you want to talk about. So we're going to stop here for a couple of commercials. 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors. Aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. We have Todd on the line from Ohio. We're talking about the economy, and I'm checking my email during the break here. We're getting a lot of email coming into the show here. Regarding the furlough in California, dear Mr. Rivero, please call me Michael. Only my students call me Mr. Rivero. I wonder if it has occurred to anyone that the governor could sell off some of his Hummers. Like maybe can Arnie spell Ford Fiesta or maybe Honda? How many Hummers does the guy have anyway? 5, 6, 7, 8 with kind regards, et cetera, et cetera. Now, not that I'm defending Arnold Schwarzenegger, but the bottom line is he did make his money. He earned it by being in his movies and so forth and so on. And I have no problem with somebody who becomes rich because they start a business or they have skills and talents that other people need that they can charge a fair market price for. That is really what capitalism is supposed to be about. My problem is with the fact that our entire economic system was hijacked in 1913. And it went from being a system where we had money that was based on a unit of wealth, of value, and we went to a monetary system where every piece of currency represents a loan with interest from a central bank. And when this country was set up originally, that kind of bank was illegal under U.S. law because the founding fathers had seen how this kind of banking system was destroying Europe slowly over time. And they didn't want it here. So the Federal Reserve Bank that we have today was actually the third effort to sell this lemon to the American people. And it was pushed through only because the congressman that voted for it, who profited from it quite handsomely, they literally voted it through over the Christmas break, 1913. They went into the Capitol building. They voted to waive the quorum rule, which says you've got to have a minimum number of Congress people to conduct business. So it was just a handful of these guys. They went in, they voted through the Federal Reserve Act. Woodrow Wilson signed it into law because that was the deal he had made to get the money to run for the White House. And he wrote in his memoirs, "I have destroyed my own country by doing this." And he was absolutely correct. So, Arnold, I think my gripe with Arnold Schwarzenegger right now, and he's a nice guy and he's fun to work with. He's got a great sense of humor, which especially with English not being his native language, that's a very difficult thing to do, to just spontaneously make jokes in a foreign language. So he's a very sharp individual. But he was not skilled with management and governance, and I keep going back to this comment he made during his campaign.
Now, there's another way you can tell you're Republican. Your faith in free enterprise, faith in the resourcefulness of the American people, and faith in the U.S. economy. And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
So, yeah, he looks good. He stands up there. He poses great. And he can do really good speeches, but he's not qualified to be in politics any more than Sarah Palin is. It's just eye candy. And we've reached the stage in the nation's history where we vote the eye candy and the good-looking suit. You know, we'll soon catch up with Italy, which has voted a couple of porn stars into their legislature at this point. That's a completely out-of-control wacko they are over there. Anyway, to get back to you, Todd, you had some other things you wanted to talk about. Name one.
Well, the key thing I called about was, this is something I've touched on before, and that is how, I mean, this is a challenge both to you and to everyone listening, and that is to think about what can we both individually and collectively do to solve this. And that's why I brought up the whole issue of the media. I would say first and foremost, we as a people must take back our power of individual or independent thought from all of these intellectual prostitutes in the media.
We're doing it. That's what you're doing here.
Right. Well, I'm just saying on a
larger scale. And we've got their audience. Hang on a second. Todd, just give me a second here, because we're already doing that. Because you're here, we've got all the listeners are tuned in. They're plugged in over the Internet. They're listening on our AM and FM affiliates across the country. And we're getting the audience. Every day we hear of another newspaper that's had to shut down or another radio station that's gone out of business because the advertisers are leaving them because they don't have the audience anymore. So I think despite its anchor foundation location in the network mechanism, in the electronic mechanism. They're still the centerpiece of the mass media distribution system over TV networks and so forth and so on. But it doesn't mean they've got the audience, and it doesn't mean they still have control over what people are thinking. I think that time is now past. And the global protests and revolutions that we're starting to see, I think, are a symptom of that. So now we have to figure out what is the next step. And I think we're at the point right now where instead of complaining about the corporate media, because we're past them already, now we've got to think about, can the system as it exists today be saved? And more to the point, should we bother? Because is the system as it is configured today working in the interests of all of its people or just a select group of beneficiaries? And if it's the latter, you know, it's like I told people back when we were looking at the out-of-control national debt even before all the bailouts, as we could spend our entire lives working and slaving away to get the U.S. government out of debt, and at the end of all that sacrifice, what would we have? We'd still have a government that's reading our emails, breaking into our computers, peeking through our windows, and unwilling to trust us. And, you know, who needs to work an entire lifetime for that?
I guess the reason why I think we've the alternative media may have captured the public mind to a certain extent, but the reason I still think people haven't withdrawn from the media enough, all you have to do is look at the third-party vote count of last November. I've been following politics a long time. That's the lowest I've ever seen it. I mean, all the third-party candidates combined got less than 1%.
You got to put the vote fraud factor in there as well. You got to put the vote fraud factor in there, and the fact that the corporate media owns the vote counting company.
Right.
And Todd, we got to let you go. The lines are filling up, and I got to get a couple of calls in here before the next break. So we're going to go quick as a bunny to Thomas in Sweden. Thomas, aloha, welcome to the show. We're going to have to be fast because we've got Robert waiting on the line as well. Thomas?
I'm real glad that
Hello?
Coyote didn't get... Hello, you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Go on.
Okay, I'm real glad that Coyote didn't get Roadrunner today. Otherwise, this is for Carolyn in Florida. Don't believe this Western Hemisphere stuff. Here are two quick examples. One, when the Monroe Doctrine was introduced, it was the Royal Navy, the British Royal Navy, who enforced it for the United States because we didn't have a navy at the time. And two, during the Falklands War, when the United States was obliged under the Organization of American States to defend Argentina against the United Kingdom, instead, the Air Force in unmarked tankers refueled Royal Air Force planes. That's what it's all. Forget about the Western Hemisphere. That's just a joke. And I'll let you get back to your next caller, okay?
All right. Thanks a lot, Thomas. And please call in again. We're waiting for Clarence to call now that you've called in. We're going to go to Robert. Robert, aloha. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I'm wondering what you think about what's going to happen to Central America and South America, you know, if and when the North American Union does fall into place. I'm kind of wondering what's going to happen to those two countries down there.
I think probably their natural resources are going to get looted, and they're going to get American manufacturing jobs in far greater numbers than they're already getting. The whole point of globalism, like I keep saying, is we have these very rich people who think the world will run much more smoothly if they can just go anywhere on the planet without restriction. And, yeah, it's going to make their businesses more profitable, but in the end, it's creating a situation like if you have a building and you take out all the fire doors because it lets people move around the building much more rapidly, the first time you get a fire in an office, you're going to lose the whole building. That's what's happening right now. The problems with the economy in the United States, the mortgage crisis and all the mortgage-backed securities is dragging the rest of the world down with it because the natural safety barriers of national borders were removed. So globalism is the reason the entire world is suffering this financial calamity, and yet everybody seems to want to sell more globalism as the solution for it. That's like saying, hey, let's ram an iceberg on the other side of the bow and see if that keeps the Titanic from sinking.
Yep. If I could get your input on one other thing, I got to tell you.
Real quick.
I'm not sure if there's any fixing what's going on here in the U.S., and I'm half tempted to just jump ship and move to Central America or South America, but I'm not sure I'd be jumping from the frying pan to the skillet. What's your thoughts on actually moving to one of those other countries like South America, Central America?
Well, a lot of people are leaving. I know some people who've moved to Chile who say it's actually a lot better there, but you got to decide for yourself. And I wish I could give you more information, Robert. All right, we got to take a break here for some commercials and news. When we come back, we're going to pick right back up. More economic news, more about Gaza and Israel. We'll be back after the news break.
Are you ready for a world of challenge, of possibilities, of ambiguity and adventure? Be a part of the National Clandestine Service at the Central Intelligence Agency. Are you a person of purpose, professionalism, with a strong sense of patriotism? Make a world of difference as a CIA officer with the National Clandestine Service. Learn more at CIA.gov. The work of a nation, the center of intelligence. Equal opportunity employer. U.S. citizenship required.
Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
Aloha, America. Welcome back to hour two of our Saturday show, looking back at the news over the last week here. And a special shout out to all of our AM and FM stations that join us for this second hour. I want to start this portion of our show talking about this story that we've just this moment put it up on the whatreallyhappened.com website. We had a mention about it earlier in the week, but we're just putting it up again because this is an important story. It's not getting a lot of coverage from a lot of places, but we need to look at it. The headline is Defense Department. Let me say that again. Defense Department establishes civilian expeditionary workforce. Now, you know, when the government starts talking with more and more words and they get gratuitously polysyllabic, it means they're kind of hiding something. And what this story is about is Deputy Defense Secretary Gordon England signed Defense Department Directive 1404.10, which defines, outlines, and guidance about this program. And he signed it just about a week ago, January 23rd. And it's supposed to be about a volunteer force, what they're calling expeditionary workforce. Now, what this is really talking about is they have the regular military soldiers who are out on the front lines and they're shooting bullets and they're catching bullets, unfortunately. And they're out there. But there's all the support personnel behind them, logistics, drivers, all the rest of that. A lot of that got contracted out to Halliburton at tremendous expense. Now they're talking about having sort of a second-tier military force working directly for the U.S. government called the Civilian Expeditionary Workforce. Here is the kicker. Within the directive, it says that they will seek volunteers for this expeditionary force before requiring anyone to serve involuntarily or on short notice. Overseas duty tours shall not exceed 2 years. Folks, this is a backdoor draft. They're not calling it a draft because the people who are being required to serve in these civilian expeditionary workforces are not, in theory, going to be exposed to combat. But it's a draft. They're talking about conscripting young Americans to basically go over, and they're going to be in a war zone, and they may not be given guns and body armor, but they're going to be at risk. We know how the lifespan of truck drivers in Iraq has not been all that encouraging, and even the people behind the lines, far back, they still get to breathe those chemicals and the depleted uranium dust and the leftover chemical munitions that are drifting in on the breeze. And they're talking about requiring people to serve in the civilian expeditionary workforce. This has happened without a word out of the United States Congress. I don't know what this guy thinks his legal authority to go out and require people to serve in the civilian expeditionary workforce is. But it sounds to me like this passes the duck test. If it sounds like a draft and looks like a draft and smells like a draft, then it's a draft. And I don't care what language they put in there. And this idea of requiring anyone to serve involuntarily is banned under the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution, the Involuntary Servitude Clause of the Bill of the Constitution. The government cannot force you to work at something other than if you have been duly convicted. I mean, they can put you out, on a chain gang if you rob a bank or something like that. But the 13th Amendment says they can't grab you and make you do things. Now, this is sort of a little polite ceremony they do in the military to get around that. They talk about, you know, you're here because you volunteer to be here, which is a complete lie. But there's this little moment where they say, all those who wish to serve in the U.S. military take a step forward. And then they kind of kick you from behind. And the instant you take that step, that is legally construed that you volunteered for service rather than you got a draft card and threatening letters from the military to show up or else. But the 13th Amendment of the Constitution forbids the government from grabbing you and saying you've got to go out and serve in the civilian expeditionary workforce. The 13th Amendment prohibits the government from saying you've got to go out and take this shovel and fill in the potholes on the road. So we seem to be entering this new era where the Constitution has just been totally abandoned, even by Barack Obama and his people. I have an interesting story to tell. I'm going to take a few minutes, a little personal anecdote from my family history. I had this grandfather, a very wonderful gentleman, and I still have in a frame all of his World War I decorations and his draft card. And it's kind of an interesting little story behind that because, and this will tell you a lot about my family and their sense of humor. My grandfather was drafted during World War I. And he never reported at the draft board. And so they sent the marshals around to say, where is he? He's supposed to be at the draft board, and he has failed to show, and we're going to... And my family would say, oh, I don't know. I think he was over... he's down Nashua last week, somewhere around there. And running these guys all over the state of New Hampshire, back and forth, back and forth. The reason my grandfather didn't show up at the draft board was he had already volunteered. He was part of the original, he was part of the New Hampshire State Guard, first unit that was activated for the Yankee Division. And when his draft notice showed up at his house in New Hampshire, he was already in France breathing German mustard gas. And the attitude of my family was, well, if the government's too stupid to know where he is, we're not going to educate them. And they ran these marshals all over the state of New Hampshire, just ran them ragged. Oh, no, he's over there in Manchester. Saw him there just last night. Just go on down that way. Anyway, so it does look, this thing about the civilian expeditionary workforce, and like I said, the more syllables they put into it, the worse they're trying to screw you. They really are. It's a lot like Germany. If you look at the German languages that evolved during the whole time of the Nazis, it just got more and more gratuitously polysyllabic and very flowery and decorative, and more euphemistic, because they didn't want to tell you what was really going on here. We're going to grab you. We're going to force you to go fight in the war zones, but it's not a draft. It's draft light, new and improved. Anyway, if you'd like to join us on the air for this hour, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. And I'm going to talk a little bit here about this brouhaha over Bishop Richard Williamson. Now, Bishop Richard Williamson dared express an opinion regarding the historical accuracy of the orthodox and officially government-approved version of the history of World War II. And he is on record as saying that he himself has never seen any evidence to confirm the story of intentional gassings of prisoners in the German slave labor camps. Now, a lot of people died in those slave labor camps. A lot of people died, mostly from the typhus outbreaks at the end of World War II. Historian David Cole went in and interviewed the director of the Auschwitz Museum and confirmed that the crematorium that is shown to the tourists as being the work of the Nazis was actually built by the Russians after the end of the war to try and deal with the typhus epidemics because the corpses were highly, highly contagious. And we've all read the Lauter report. They went over Treblinka with ground-penetrating radar. They couldn't find that stuff. We know about all the literary hoaxes going on and on and on. So, a reasonable person would conclude that while it may be impossible to say what did or did not happen there, that it is perfectly valid to say it needs a closer look. We need to look at the actual facts and get away from a lot of the post-war pro-Israel propaganda that has come out of that. We know the story about the soap was a complete hoax. We know the story about the lampshades was a complete hoax. The story about the machine that vaporized its victims so that that was the reason no traces could be found of them. We know that was a hoax. Okay? Everybody lies. Because of the story of Saddam's nuclear bombs used to sell us the war in Iraq, we know our government lies to us. Therefore, we are justified and prudent in saying, okay, anything we have ever been taught by the media, the state-sponsored schools, we need to go back and take a look so that we know what the truth really is. And yet, this is proving to be very dangerous. We've got to take a break here, and we're going to come back. I want to talk about this situation with the bishop and the pope and Israel and the U.S. Congress, and we'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
You're listening to the Genesis Communications Network. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show today. And we're talking about Bishop Richard Williamson, who had been excommunicated by the Catholic Church. He has just been re-communicated or un-excommunicated or dis-whatever it is by Pope Benny. And it's caused a huge furor because Bishop Richard Williamson has expressed doubts about the historical accuracy of the Orthodox government-approved story of the history of World War II. Now, everybody has a right to an opinion, of course. And what we have seen in the last week is the Israeli government and rabbis within the Jewish faith just go into this tremendous, tremendous angst over the fact that Bishop Richard Williamson has been brought back into the church, and a great deal of pressure is being exerted on the Pope to reverse his decision or to otherwise coerce the bishop into changing his views. Now, if Richard Williamson was a rabbi, I would consider it to be very appropriate for other members of the Jewish faith to say, you know, we have a set of beliefs here that you must conform to. But in this case, what we have here is members of one religion using basically coercive means bordering on force to force members of another religion to believe as the first religion tells them to. And I have a problem with this because not only is it inappropriate, but left unchecked, these kind of things wind up with members of both religions screaming at each other, holding swords, slicing each other's throats wide open while screaming, God wills it, God wills it. And I sort of hope we had left that kind of thing behind 200 years ago. Maybe not. Maybe not. Now we have 50 Catholic members of the U.S. Congress have all signed a letter to Pope Benny asking him to directly and officially reject the views of Bishop Richard Williamson. Now, first of all, these 50 Catholic members to basically side with Israel, I think, betrays a certain vested interest at work here. But the issue I have with this first and foremost is the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States that every one of those members of Congress has sworn an oath to uphold. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And for these 50 congressmen to basically sell out their oath of office and the most important principle of the United States of America in order to take sides in this argument, I think it's shameful. These members of Congress should be ashamed of themselves. I'm going to dig their names out. The names have not been released yet. I'm going to find out who they are, and we're going to hold them up for public ridicule and humiliation for simply walking away from the most cherished foundation of our system of government, the right to freedom of speech and opinion. I mean, if you have people walking around who claim Elvis is still alive, we don't round them up and throw them in jail. We don't wreck their careers. People who claim to have seen Bigfoot, we don't send them to Germany to be locked up in prison. People who claim that they've been taken up for rides in UFOs are not harassed in the media. They're given shows on History Channel these days. Only in this one area of inquiry is so much force brought to bear to coerce people to go along with the revealed wisdom. Now, I was raised with the orthodox story of the history of World War II. I had uncles who served in Europe in World War II who told me point blank, don't believe what you're being told, because we were there. They helped liberate some of these camps. And they came back and said, what you're being told now, it isn't true. I didn't listen. I was 8 years old. I wasn't paying attention back then. But they tried to tell me. What convinced me something is going on is, first and foremost, the very actions of those defending the orthodox story. Because they don't come up with facts and figures. They don't come up with scientific forensic evidence. It's jail and prosecution and career wrecking. Tools of tyrants. The tools of people with something to hide. Truth does not need any law to support it. Truth is unafraid of question. Truth survives re-examination. Throughout history, from Galileo to Bruno to Zundel, only lies and liars resort to the courts to force adherence to dogma. The bottom line is, we know governments lie to their people to sell them things, to sell them agendas. There's nothing new with that. Go back, visit ancient Egypt sometime, go to the temples of Karnak and Abydos and Luxor, and you will see carvings of Ramses II, called Ramses the Great by his own admission, victorious over the Hittites at Kadesh, crushing their bodies under the wheels of his chariot. Ramses didn't actually beat the Hittites at Kadesh. He walked into a trap, he got suckered in. He almost lost his entire army, and he had to sign a peace treaty, a non-aggression pact, which ended Egypt's period of expansion, which is why Ramses then went on a building boom, putting up all these buildings all over Egypt, proclaiming what a really wonderful guy he was. And here we are, thousands of years later, and that lie, that piece of propaganda by the Egyptian leader to his own people, because he knew they weren't going to go up to Kadesh and find out for themselves what happened. They didn't have the money to do it. And anybody who did go up and find out it was a lie didn't have the means to get the word out to the rest of the people. There was no internet back then. So Ramses put up all these huge stone billboards saying, I whipped those Hittites at Kadesh. Aren't I wonderful? And all these thousands of years later, we can still see it. And every one of those carvings is a reminder that leaders of nations lie to their people shamelessly. They teach you to be truthful so that it makes it easier for them to lie to you and get away with it. So, as we look back on the claims that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons that turned out not to exist, or the torpedoes in the Gulf of Tonkin, which didn't exist, or the Spanish mine in Havana Harbor, Maine, that didn't exist, or the current proclamations of Iran's nuclear threat, which likewise does not exist, it is worth remembering that there is nothing that we have been taught throughout our entire lives that is above re-examination, that is above suspicion. Bishop Richard Williamson has an opinion. And having an opinion should not be subject to coercion or force or pressure. And it should not be punishable by law. In the United States, the First Amendment of the Constitution says everybody has a right to their opinion and they have a right to express it. And those 50 Catholic members of Congress who have written to Pope Benny asking him to control Bishop Richard Williamson to please their Israeli donors or their Jewish American donors, they have totally abandoned and betrayed the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, and they should be ashamed of themselves for it. This is about free speech. This is about, this is the fundamental issue of our country, our first and foremost value for which so many millions have died in wars. We are told to preserve this very right. And these 50 members of Congress just thrown in the trash can. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors. And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. We've got a caller on the line, and I apologize. I let him sit there through the whole last segment because I wanted to get that stuff out there. So we're going to go to Don in Texas. Aloha, Don. Welcome to the show. What is on your mind today?
Oh, hi there. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I was just calling, you know, coinciding with what you're talking about with McWilliams there. By the way, I knew a medic that was in World War II, and he said, you know, he gave a different resume of what the problem was. Oh, there's a lot of cholera and hepatitis and a lot of other things that kill a lot of those people in those camps. And those people in those camps were valuable assets to the Germans. They were workers. They worked on producing material for the German war effort. You know, they were factories. Well,
yes.
Anyway, what I was going to say about Bobby Fischer, you know, the chess champion. And I have relatives in the outskirts of Iceland. I have Danish ancestry, and actually from Denmark. But he was sent there as kind of as a sanctuary because he spoke out against the outrages of the rabbis and all that in the New York City area. He was originally Jewish, you know. Are you there?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Well, and I have no real proof that he was terminated. You know, there's many chemicals and different little pills and things you can do to people to make it look like they just had a heart attack. You know.
Yes, there are. And
he was
unfortunately.
Wasn't he trying to compile a volume of material, a one or two volume set of books that would show a lot of information about the Holocaust, you know, make it look like it was kind of a con deal, you know.
Well, you know, a lot of people have done that, and, you know, they do come under some extraordinary pressure to halt it, and they can never find publishers. You know, look what happened with Walt and Mearsheimer when they came out just with the issue about the Zionist lobby. And unfortunately, the irony with that is every time they do something like this, it just reinforces that image. I mean, look what happened in Spain, where Spain had announced they were going to do war crimes investigations into Israel, and the Spanish government comes back and says, oh, no, we're going to change the law so you can't do that.
You know why
they
can do that?
How much more blatant and obvious can it get?
They do,
and it's being done with money that's printed up out of thin air.
Well, people are cowardly. Once they get in high position, they don't want to lose their comfortable position and all their, you know, nice little things, and they will turn against their better instincts and their they'll have to, like that bishop, or what was he, a bishop, that he had to get up and say, oh, no, I was just making that up, and I'm sorry, you know. He was forced to recant. And you know, you don't do that unless you're under pressure, and the reason you're under pressure is so they can continue with this mind control they have of, they can get by with anything, because they can say, oh, we had a Holocaust, and it gives us we're the master race, and whatever we do, no matter how hideous, people are 90% of the American people are uninformed and scared to even think.
Well, I don't think it's 90% anymore. I think the percentage is definitely dwindling. We're going to have to let you go here, Don, because we've got another caller on the line, and we're getting tight for time today. So thank you very much for the call. And the bottom line, though, is that in this age of the global electronic village and the Internet and alternative media, the fact is that every time Israel's interests do something like this, like they just did in Spain, it becomes very, very obvious what's going on. The situation at the Davos Economic Summit, where the moderator was so blatantly trying to throw the debate in favor of Israel to the point where the president of Turkey just walked out at the obviousness of it all. This is now news around the world. The corporate media can't keep you from seeing this anymore. And that's why this iron grip that Israel has enjoyed on the governments of the world, it's starting to slip. And I think that's a big aspect of these protests that we're seeing erupt around the world. We're going to go to John in Ohio. Aloha, John. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Yes, that word, master race, has a lot of coincidence with the ideology of the Zionists, the chosen people who set up with the help of the U.S. military-industrial complex, this attack dog, this outpost for the worst warmongers within the elite, within the United States and the Anglo-American establishment to do their intimidation and terror and aggression against any kind of independent nationalist Arab or Palestinian movements in the Middle East. It has nothing to do with the Holocaust or any sympathy for them that the United States actually prevented survivors of Nazi persecution to come into the United States precisely because they wanted there under a government that the United States would be able to use as an attack dog, a hammer against the rising decolonizing movements after the Second World War, and they've filled that role ever since, and has nothing to do with any kind of sympathy for the survivors of Nazi persecution, because the United States government actually prevented them from coming in. And there's a one of the a Zionist who doesn't realize his own contradiction, Ben Hecht, the famous playwright, wrote the Broadway and movie with, you know, Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell, Front Page. He was an avid Zionist, and he actually came across documents, the Israeli documents brought out by an Israeli court before it was shut up in his book Perfidy, that the Zionists were the collaborators, the eager collaborators with the Nazis against the non-Zionist Jews, and they helped them persecute and eliminate many Jews precisely because they had they were totally contemptuous of any Jew who was not a Zionist.
Yeah.
And that's actually been proven in actually Israeli documents. Some of the founders of Israel, like Rudolf Kastner, in the cabinet and others were collaborators with Nazis because they had this right-wing attitude very similar to the Nazis. And they actually, according to another Jew, he wrote the book Zionism in the Age of the Dictator, Lenny Brenner, and you can get that probably. And he shows that from Army documents declassified that it was a Zionist establishment that throughout the war collaborated with the Nazis, not against them, against the left and against the communists who were prominent in the resistance against the Nazis. So this is one of the biggest chutzpah hoaxes of all time, that the Israelis have been able to milk the Holocaust when the Israeli government, when they were the ones that collaborated with the Nazis against the, at that time, the 99% Jews who were not non-Zionist.
Okay, now let me respond to that, because we're almost out of time for this segment. Thank you very much for the call here. What you need to do is look at it from the point of view of the founders of the nation of Israel. They had a huge public relations problem because the entire world had united against the Axis powers on the principle that Adolf Hitler did not have a right to march into Poland and steal that country for the use of the German people. That was the principle for which we sacrificed so much blood and so much treasure. And yet Israel needed some kind of a propaganda device so that the world would say that what it was not okay for Nazi Germany to do to Poland and France was okay for the new nation of Israel to do to Palestine. And that was the reason that this whole Holocaust story was promoted so hard, because the entire world had to be convinced that what was not okay for Germany to do to Poland and France had to be okay for Israel to do to Palestine. And that was really the motivation for all of that. So, we're going to take a break. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Can we talk?
Can we talk?
Can we talk about gun control?
Gun control?
Seems like it should work, doesn't it?
It should work.
You'd think so. Yeah.
Pass the right laws.
Pass the right laws.
And you can disarm the criminals.
You disarm them.
That's the idea.
But the problem is...
The problem?
Criminals don't obey the law.
They don't obey the law.
That's true.
After all, they're criminals.
They're criminals.
Criminals. They'll always find a way to get guns.
No matter how many laws you pass.
Which means
they still have guns.
They still have guns. While the rest of us...
The rest of us?
The rest of us are just left defenseless.
This is the GCN Radio Network, home to hard-hitting talk radio.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future, and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show here. And I want to talk this last segment as we wind up the show for today. Tomorrow is the Super Bowl. And, you know, we can all, everybody's down there. They're getting their potato chips and their popcorn and their cases of beer. And it's really become almost in its own right a religious ritual. And, you know, the parties are all cranking up and everything. And unfortunately, I don't get that excited about the Super Bowl. I used to, because I used to make TV commercials that would actually be played on the Super Bowl. I've been thus honored in many, many years past. But these days, I really, every time I see a big football game, whether it's Super Bowl or Rose Bowl or everything, I keep thinking back to, like, the movie, John Frankenheimer's Black Sunday, and the blimp comes in that's going to kill people as an act of terror. And I also think about Tom Clancy's book, The Sum of All Fears. Now, I'm a big Tom Clancy fan. He writes very readable techno thrillers. He invented the genre. I don't like his books because he portrays the CIA as we wish they were, rather than as we know they all are. But that issue aside, he does write some very good books. And he wrote a book called The Sum of All Fears about a nuclear bomb, terrorist nuclear bomb set off in the Super Bowl. Now, the movie version of the story kind of pared it down and just kept it very simple. Terrorists set off nuclear bomb in Super Bowl. You know, bad, bad, bad people. The book was really much more interesting because the plot of the book was that the people who set off the nuclear bomb in the Super Bowl did it to trick the U.S. into attacking somebody else entirely. And that's a very important issue to keep in mind in our current geopolitical situation, because yesterday's big news late at night, the Israeli ambassador to Australia slipped up and made some very belligerent statements about an imminent confrontation with the nuclear threat of Iran before he realized he was being videotaped and ordered the media to shut the cameras off before continuing to his group of the local Jewish community in Sydney, I believe it was. Now, only a week ago, we had Benjamin Netanyahu, who was expected to win the Israeli election, saying that Al-Qaeda is going to destroy Jesus Christ's presumed burial site at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And when I heard him say that, I thought back to what Benjamin Netanyahu said about 9/11 on the very day of the attack. He said, well, this is a good thing. Then he backed up and said, no, well, it's not a good thing, but it's going to build sympathy for Israel, which was certainly true enough. And Israel has had this huge war on terror shield that it has been using to deflect criticism over what it's doing in other countries, whether it's Lebanon or Gaza. and certainly has allowed the continuing flow of billions of our tax dollars into Israel at a time when Americans are sleeping in alleys and eating out of trash cans. And as a matter of fact, Netanyahu has repeatedly said throughout the years that the 9/11 terror attacks were a good thing for Israel. This is a quote. We are benefiting from one thing, and that is the attack on the Twin Towers and Pentagon and the American struggle in Iraq. And Netanyahu then went on saying that the events had swung American public opinion in our favor. So what is going to happen now that American opinion is very clearly swinging away from Israel? Right now, Israel, because of what it did in Gaza and the very blatant lies that they have had exposed about what they did in Gaza, American public support is definitely on the wane, without which Israel cannot pursue its agenda. So I don't want to be the one to be making dire predictions, and, you know, more than likely I'm wrong about it, but if I was going to the Super Bowl, I'd be a little bit nervous. Because we know that a lot of the so-called acts of terror that are being waved at us may, in fact, be something else entirely. We know that right after 9/11, when there was all of this huge amount of evidence pointing the finger of blame at Arab Muslims, we know that the people who were actually caught high-fiving each other and cheering as the towers came down turned out to be Mossad. We know that when the anthrax letters started showing up in various places around the U.S. country, they included actual letters that appeared to be written by semi-literate Arab Muslims. Allah is great, death to America, that kind of stuff. And then it turned out the anthrax came from a U.S. government weapons laboratory. And regardless of whether you think Philip Zack did it or Stephen Hatfield, or this last guy who committed suicide and allowed the FBI to say, okay, that was him, case closed, none of them were Arab Muslims. And so the existence of these letters written to put the blame on Arab Muslims is proof that there is a frame-up of some kind going on. It's a false flag attack. Right now, our world is cursed with a lot of leaders who see a new global war as their way out of their problems. We've got the heads of Europe are looking at riots and protests in their own country, open talk of rebellion and revolution because of the economic disaster they brought down on their own people. We're seeing that same sort of thing here in the United States. We know that the United States has a prior history of getting out of previous Great Depressions by getting involved in a world war. And no doubt this is at least part of the impetus to go on trying to get a new regional war going in the Mideast. Iraq has kind of gone lukewarm. Afghanistan's kind of fizzling. They need a new war they can sell us so that we'll all unite behind the U.S. government. Because it's one thing, when you have a world war going on, the American people historically will tolerate hunger, shortages, going without so the government can have more. But if there is no war and the American people are still going hungry and they're having to do without, through no fault of their own, they're going to turn on the government. That is an absolute historical fact. So our government is desperate to crank up a war as a distraction, as an excuse. And, of course, you have over in Israel, they have a long history of wanting to trick the U.S. into war on Israel's enemies. The Levon affair back in the 1950s, Israeli agents were bombing British and American targets in Egypt and planting evidence to frame Egyptians. When Israel attacked the USS Liberty, it was Israel that was sending out messages, Egypt is attacking a U.S. ship. Had the Liberty actually sunk, there was already a bombing mission in the air on the way to Cairo, nuclear armed, I might add. It was recalled only at the last second when it became obvious that the USS Liberty was going to survive the attack and basically blow the whistle that it was Israel that had been doing it all along. The attack on USS Cole may have been more of the same. A lot of questions remain about that one. The Mossad's motto is, by way of deception, thou shalt do war. Israel by itself cannot wage war on its enemies sitting on land that Israel believes God intended them to have. So they love to trick other nations to make war on their enemies. And they have a long history of doing this. We know that a great deal of the information, disinformation that helped sell the war in Iraq to the American people came from Israel through AIPAC, through its agent in place inside the Pentagon Office of Special Plans, Larry Franklin, and from there to the White House, and from there to the American people. We know that the documents about Niger uranium being bought by Iraq that Bush referenced in its 2003 State of the Union speech, those were forgeries, crude ones. The Italian Parliament investigated and named Michael Ledeen as one of the forgers of those documents. We know that Iran is building a nuclear power station, which is their legal right under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. We know they are enriching uranium to the levels required for fuel rods, also their right under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. We know the IAEA is in Iran keeping an eye on things, and they have found no evidence of a clandestine weapons program. There is no Iranian nuclear threat. We're being sold that there is one. Why? Who benefits from war in Iran? The U.S. government gets its distraction and gets to blame the economic hardships on the war instead of on their own idiotic economic policies. Israel gets to expand its territory and let other people's children die for it. It's a very, very dark time and a very dangerous time. And now we have this Israeli ambassador basically admitting accidentally on videotape that a confrontation with Iran is imminent. It's a very nervous time. We're going to stop here. It's the end of our show. We'll be back Monday at our usual time with your phone calls, more news. Until then, stay safe, be well, enjoy the Super Bowl, and Aloha America.